Our next speaker, good friend of mine, lives in my neighborhood, Tom Butler.
Well, it's great to be with you tonight. What I'm about to share, I've shared with some close friends, of course my family, and a couple of very small like youth groups with about 10 or 12 people a couple of times, never in a public forum like this. And so when I went back to review my notes from 1999, from my journal entry, it was yesterday and part of today, and I had some flashbacks that weren't very pleasant. But anyway, hopefully I'll get through this for you. How many of you have been to Cancun? I had the opportunity to live down there for nearly 5 years. As I like to say, there's a lot of worse places to live than Cancun. I actually went down on vacation with my wife, and we're sitting there, just to give you a little background, we're sitting there on the beach. You know, the beaches are unbeatable. Scuba diving is, you know, well, not that great in Cancun, but you go across the strait there, Cozumel, and it's world class. Anyway, I thought, you know what, I need to move back here. So I racked my brain on what I could do, and I came up with the idea of I could put in some of the hotels and other tourist locations there in Cancun, and one thing led to another, and 6 months later we were down there. This is in 1994. Anyway, for nearly 5 years, I drugged my wife. We had two children when we moved down there, and for part of that time, she was pregnant. I drug her with our third child all over southern Mexico to a lot of the Mayan ruins. Some of you have heard of them. Not the big touristy ones like Chichen Itza and Tulum and some of those others that are close to Cancun that, you know, they put people on buses and hundreds and thousands of people go every day. I'm talking about the ones that are obscure that I read about in some manuscript written from a guy, you know, some scholar. From, I said, man, I can go see that place. That sounds like, you know, it matches up with, you know, Zarahemla or something, you know. And so I did that, and you might say I was throwing caution to the wind, but, you know, Quintana Roo was very safe. They protect that very well for the tourists. And to make a long story short, I thought, well, we'll just go and hopefully everything will be okay. And I, nearly 5 years, I never had any problems at all. I made sure I was pulled over by a policeman once in a while for, you know, a traffic violation. And you know how that goes, right? You know, give them a few pesos for a chela, as they call it, and that's just the way it is down there. And, you know, it's either that or spend a whole day in the court system, and that's it. When in Rome, does Rome. So, I felt really comfortable. I was very fluent in Spanish. April of 1999, it was time for us to come back to the States. We've been down there nearly 5 years. My wife and three children, I put them on a plane from Cancun to Salt Lake, and they flew home. My mother had flown down to Cancun to drive out with me. We had some, you know, had a Ford Explorer that I didn't really want to ship, and had some other items that personal items, photos, and, you know, family stuff that I didn't want to ship because when we got there, actually some of the stuff in our shipping container got lost, and things disappear overseas, and especially in Mexico, and you know how that goes. So I'm just going to drive it out, and that way my mom could see some of these ruins that I'd taken my children and wife to over the years. So we headed out on April 11th, 1999. First day we drove down to Chetumal, and actually stayed near there, a place called Bacalar, and the next morning went to this little Spanish fort that was, you know, been built there back in the 1500s to defend the Spanish conquista. That was Sunday morning, then we started heading west. The first room we went to was Zibanche, which is west of Chetumal. Everything was fine, saw the place, nice little ruins, but the place I really wanted to take her to was a place called Kompulich, which was about, half an hour south of the highway and about a little further to the west. And we were going to head west from there, and you know, it's basically, well, you can do it in 3 days. It's a long 3-day drive from the time you hit the U.S. border until you get to Cancun, because, as you know, Mexico is kind of shaped like the palm of your hand. You know, Texas is here, more or less. You have to come all the way down to the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico and all the way back up into the Yucatan Peninsula. So Chetumal is down here, all right? From here, you go this way, and then you can start going north. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Sunday, April 11th, I'm going along with my mother. She's having a great time. We're just, you know, chewing the breeze, and we're headed south on this little paved road going down to Kompulich. To let you know another thing, every 6 years or so, there's a government election in Mexico. And whether it be municipal, you know, the city level, state level, or federal, they're all at different times. Sometimes they don't overlap. But there's always, whenever that happens, there's a huge change in the government. Now, we have that here as well. But not as drastic. In other words, when the new mayor comes in, he cleans house and brings all of his buddies in. When the new governor comes in, everybody comes in. And everybody who's not just a peon low-level employee gets switched out. Every supervisor, advisor, administrator, what have you. You know, kind of what George Bush did a few years ago, but with the attorneys. But that's a side note. They clean the house completely. And so all of the state police, FBI guys, you know, those kind of guys, everybody is turned over practically. And so we're driving down this road, and the state bed truck is behind me. And I see it in the mirror. And by the way, this 4x4 is packed so tight. I felt like I was in an F-16 practically, because everything was packed in around me to the strip homes, anything that I didn't want to ship or I was afraid to ship. You know, our TV and my wife's sewing machine and old family videos and business reports and all this kind of stuff. And so there really wasn't any room at all for more than two people. And packed tight and running, you know, riding like this. That's how heavy it was. And so we get to, going down this road, and I look in the mirror, and there's a state bed truck behind us, a large state bed truck. And it's coming up kind of fast. Being the, you know, polite person that I am, I kind of pulled over, and I wasn't in any hurry. It was 3 o'clock in the afternoon, bright, sunny, Sunday afternoon. This was our last location to see, and then go back to the hotel. And so I just waved them around. They pull around, and the guy on the passenger side waves his badge at me. So I thought it was a little bit odd, but then the truck pulls in front of me and kind of forces me off the road. He gets out of the passenger side of the truck, comes over to my driver's side, and I'm just, you know, hindsight, 2020, right? There's a lot of things I would have done differently. And I'm glad I can sit here and tell you now what I would do in that situation. But at the moment, I've been there for 5 years, never had a problem, never had an issue with anyone. Love Mexico still, love the Mexican people, got a lot of good friends. This guy comes up and he says in Spanish, you know, he's hablas español, así. So he's talking in Spanish, and then he goes into English for a minute, broken English, and he says, we're investigating a tourist incident. Two tourists have a problem in this area. You know anything about it? I said, no, we just got in this area. I don't know anything about it. He steps back for a second and pulls a .357 out from behind his belt from the driver's side window to my head, you know, was about this far. Of course, your perspective on the afternoon kind of goes out the window. And he says, get out of the blanket truck. Get out of the blanket car right now, or I'll block your blanket. You know, he was very proficient in his English, the use of one word. But I guess he got off, you know, some movies. But you know, it's worse than that album. But the F word, he was very proficient. I had hardly didn't even have an accent with it. And of course, my mom starts screaming. Two other guys hop down out of the truck. One with a sawed-off shotgun, come around to her side of the vehicle, and you know, they're screaming, "Get out!" You know. Anyway, looking down the wrong end of a firearm is not a pleasant thing. I'm a Second Amendment supporter. I believe in firearms, the right to keep bare arms, but now I got one pointed at my nose. Okay, that's not a pleasant thing. So I said, okay, I got money, I'll give you money, just chill out, let us go, we'll be fine. He said, no, get out of my effing car. So by this time they got my mom's door open and they're dragging her back to the truck. And by the way, she's about 65 at the time. So she was not a spring chicken, but she wasn't, you know, with a walker either at this point. And she's screaming and they're screaming, yelling, and it's pretty chaotic. And so by this time I'm out of the vehicle, I said, look, I'll give you money, just let us go, man. Just let us go. What do you want? What do you need? And he says, if you don't get the effing, you know, back to Spanish now, but he actually was using the effing with the Spanish. It was really the most amazing bilingual conversation I've ever seen. He says, if you don't get in the truck right now, I'm going to blow your effing boot right now. Okay, enough profanities for the night. And I sort of saw myself out of my body. You know, and I've never had a near-death experience. I've never, you know, gone to the side, I haven't seen Jesus, you know, or any of that kind of stuff. I've read some books on it. I appreciate and I believe what you folks, you know, are learning and studying. Okay, let's leave it there for now. I never had anything like that. But I kind of felt like myself, outside of myself, for a second, looking at myself, being shot and crumpling there on that road, in the middle of nowhere. And I can see my Explorer, I can see the guy getting in my Explorer and driving off. And didn't do what he said right then. That's what he told me. You better do what he says. So, says, okay. So I went and got the state bed truck with the guy with the shotgun. The driver, my mom, myself, shotgun guy. The boss, and he was a state police, who is he out? A judicial police, like a state trooper kind of thing. He'd been apparently let out of his job, fired from his job, and then they brought in the new cronies. I see the guy, you know, take off my Explorer, and he goes a little ways down the road, and it, you know, becomes dirt, and then he turns left onto this even smaller dirt road, heading east at this point. Okay, the state bed truck pulls behind him. We go through the, we're going through the jungle. Okay, now when you think Mexico, I don't really think desert. Well, the Yucatan Peninsula is full of jungle. Okay, not always the prettiest of jungles, but it, you know, it's not Seattle or anything, but it's jungle. And so we went. It's very thick, very desolate, if you will, in that sense. That there's not a whole lot of inhabitants. So we're going and we're on this curve up ahead about 300 yards or so. I see the brake lights on the Explorer pop on, you know, slam on, and the truck, you know, that I'm in. And I always look through the windshield, and then I look up and I see down about 300 yards a drug interdiction point. I know the Army, where they got set up to try to catch narcotraficantes. And so we're about, we stopped the vehicle probably about 300 yards away. And I see the guys, the Army guys, and I'm thinking, oh, good, here comes cavalry, right? The boss in the Explorer, driving, he says, go back the other way, you know, go back and head the other way to the hideouts, basically. And he backs up the Explorer off the road, and the two back tires, and this is not a four-wheel drive Explorer, but in California, not in Utah, so, you know, it's only two-wheel drive. And he backs up, and the two wheels go off of the road base, you know, the dirt road, and I know that Explorer, I know what the weight is, and I know he's not moving. And so he kind of sort of high centers it, and he goes, and it's not going anywhere. The Army guys are running this way. They think they've got a drug bust going down. So he yells, so, you know, they don't, you know, communication between each other, and the guy in the safe bed turns it around and heads back. And I got this, you know, shotgun in my head, the short shot shotgun. I'm thinking, man, I gotta do something. And so we get around this curve, and you know, I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer, I guess. I wasn't trained in martial arts. At the time, I didn't have a lot of gun skills, just an average guy. It took me a few seconds to put together a plan. So what I did then, so I grabbed a shotgun, you know, just real quick, I grabbed a shotgun and threw it to the floor, because I didn't think I could move it around. My mom's sitting right here next to me and stuff, didn't want the thing going off in the cab. And I grabbed the gun, and I slammed my elbow into the guy's face next to me, reached over and turned off the, popped it into neutral from the manual shift stick, the stick, and turned off the truck, and threw the keys down, foolishly hoping that would give enough time for the Army guys to come. I didn't realize that they didn't have a vehicle out there, that they were just foot soldiers with, you know, waiting for the bus to come pick them up at the end of their shift or whatever, take them home. They had no jeeps, no trucks, no nothing there. And I remember seeing them running towards us outside of my mind in retrospect, and that's why they never arrived from where I was at. So the guy, the driver, hops out and reaches out of the seat, pulls out a claw hammer. Okay, so imagine this is a truck bed here, right? And my mom's here. He reaches out to get a claw hammer. My mom's screaming, "Ah!" You know, and so I go through like this to grab his arm with the hammer. He's trying to, you know, give me another hole, another orifice in my head. And the other guy next to me, you know, recovers from his thing, and he runs out of the cab. So I'm trying to figure out a way. We're kind of at a, you know, wrestling match here with the hammer. And then I hear my mom say, scream, "Look out!" And so I turn around, and this guy, the other guy, is coming at me with a rock about like this size to slam into the side of my head. Well, fortunately, you know, the cab was sort of enclosed, so he couldn't really throw it at me. And he couldn't really even get a good, you know. So I see this arm coming through, and so I let go of the hammer with one hand, and I grabbed the other arm like this. And it sounds really weird, but here I am like this. You talk about the ultimate Mexican standoff. Hammer, an arm, rock, an arm. And I'm like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do now? This plan didn't work very well. And my mom's right between us, right? And I look over, and she's bleeding profusely from her nose, her face. And I don't know if she's been hit by the hammer, or if my elbow got her. It probably was my elbow, to be honest with you. I don't know, but she's bleeding pretty profusely from the nose. And at this point, I don't know what to do. And if I, you know, with hindsight 2020, there's a lot of things I would have done now. And, you know, I've thought about it. I've had flashbacks. I've thought about it for years. But at the time, you know, I said, okay, fine. Yeah, pasta. Okay. Yeah. And so I pulled, and I let go. And I'm thinking, hold it, by this time, maybe the Army guys made it close. And they never came. They forced me down on the floor, and this time they, you know, tied me up and gagged me, and they're not taking any chances this time. And the one guy on the other side, you know, had a broken tooth. So I guess that was one good thing, I guess, but it kind of ticked him off more than anything. And they drove us to this hideout. And it was a little farm. Well, I was blindfolded. I couldn't really see it going in the first time. But I heard the guy got out of the truck, the driver went and talked to somebody, and then they drove back, drove us into this barn area. And so I go inside, and they just get out of the truck, go inside, sit down. The one guy whose tooth was broken, he starts kicking me and beating on me a little bit. But, you know, luckily I was able, you know, I was sitting down on the ground, so, you know, it really didn't hurt too much, and my adrenaline was up pretty high, and it didn't matter anyway. Took our watches, took our rings, took, you know, went through our pockets. Most of the cash was still in the vehicle. You know, I had this bag, about $500 worth of pesos for gas and stuff to get out, you know, for things. I had this fanny pack. That was still in the vehicle. Fortunately, my mom, who's got some physical problems, Sjogren's syndrome, fibromyalgia, a few things like that, fortunately, she had her little fanny pack with her little, you know, at least a supply of meds on her, you know, teardrops, all that kind of stuff. She had that with her, thank goodness. But, so anyway, here we are sitting on the floor of this barn, and then they took us to this back room of this barn that was kind of a separate little room. There was a broken-off toilet. It was all nasty and, you know, dirty and a bunch of leaves on the ground. It was a pretty nasty place, and they made us lay down there. My mom wanted to ask them some questions. She didn't speak Spanish. They didn't speak English because the boss is the one that spoke in English, and he was with the Explorer. They made us lay down there, and she said, "What's that? You know, what are you going to do? What are you going to do?" And so they finally let me take the gag out and, you know, translate and ask the question. And they said, "Well, we'll find out when the headman gets back." Well, this is, you know, approximately 4 o'clock now in the afternoon, and the boss never came back. He never came back. He never came back. He never came back. And finally, around 11 o'clock. He came back. It was obviously dark by then. He came back in with a clown mask, a little, you know, like a Corky the Clown, old kind of party mask that, you know, that you might see on a, you know, an old TV show from the 60s or something. And he said in English, "I'd be very, very angry at you. Because of you, I lost my car, my new car, my new Ford Explorer. And I hear that you've been fighting with my men. They should have killed you a long time ago. And where you're going to die anyway, so don't even think about trying to, you know." So, and over the course of the next 36 hours or so, we were told we were going to be killed over 100 times at least. So your expectation of successful outcome is kind of non-existent at that point, okay? Not that I was, not that I'm a negative person or despair, but I'm kind of a realist. I really am a realist. People know me. You know, I'm not a real optimistic, I'm not a real pessimist. I judge things how they are from my perspective at the present, you know, in certain circumstances at the present time. And so we're laying there. In a nutshell, he said, the thing about the captors a lot of times, and you learn this from the Patty Hearst, you know, captor, you know, they try to play good cop, bad cop, and you know, if you help us, we can help you. But even then, you're still going to die, so don't worry about it, you know. But help us get some money. And then he plays this card like, you know, my little boy has leukemia, and I'm not a bad guy. I just got to do this for my son, you know, for the people. For my son, I got to get money for the treatment because they cut off my pension. They fired me from the, you know, government. Trying to make you feel sorry for him, all this kind of crap. He said to me, you know, we got to get some money, my wallet and everything, and money is in the Explorer. Passports, everything. My mom has her wallet, no passport, but her wallet in her fanny pack with her ID and, thank goodness, her Bank of America Visa card, which is about the only thing, you know, that I think that was the only credit card I think she had on her, and very little cash because I was taking care of that. So we're trying to brainstorm on how we can get this scumbag some money so that maybe she'll be able to be let go. You know, I didn't have any expectations for me, but they kind of said a couple times, "We don't want to kill your mother. We don't have to kill women, only men. But so if you cooperate, maybe we let her go. Maybe. But you, no chance." And that's fine. You know, that's fine. No one ever survived a spirit. And so we give him the... Actually, there was a debit card, too. Okay? And so she gave him the PIN number and the credit, the debit card, and said, go to, you know, and I told him, go to Chickamau, try to get some money out of the bank, maybe you can get enough for your son. You know, I said, I had trouble with international ATMs before, especially in Mexico, but, you know, maybe you can get. So that was about 11 o'clock at night. He took the card, went to town. And so for the rest of the night, we're laying there in that feces pit. And every time, you know, I didn't sleep at all, but because about every 10 minutes, and this is really on concrete, okay, first of all, then leaves, crap, some more leaves, and some more crap, probably. Every time I, you know, try to just, you know, try to get comfortable, some try to somehow get comfortable, you know, tied up, the leaves would crump, crinkle, thank you. And the flashlight would come on, and then that settled back, you know, so get comfortable, they'd trump the light, and go back to what they were doing. You know, of course, I had visions of maybe I could probably untie myself, probably overpower the guy with the shotgun, maybe get out of there, but I had my 65-year-old mom. How would we be able to run through the jungle? How would we be able to get out of there? Maybe we're fighting this other guy. I might wake up the other two guys who are outside. It didn't look like a good situation. So anyway, the rest of the night, well, the whole night, I'm feeling pretty bad, okay? Obviously. Not just because I'm in a bad situation, but because I got my mom in this bad situation because of my not being aware of my situation, the dangers around me. I didn't ever say, God, get me out of this situation. And I don't know if I say that braggingly, that I never got to the point where I'm going to try to negotiate, you know, God, get me out of here and everything. I'll never do this again, or I'll be all that. But I believe firmly that in life there's actions, reactions, and there's consequences. And I was in that situation as a consequence of not being aware of, you know, the problem situation. I couldn't blame God. I couldn't blame anyone else but me. I basically say, hey, if it be thy will, please let my mom get out of here somehow. Number two, please help my wife to find someone that will be a good husband to take care of our three kids. Because I knew, not because of this, you know, not because of being a pessimist or whatever, but I knew that I was not getting out of that situation. And I kept saying, thy will be done. And my paradigm changed, you know, from being one of scared to being one of, okay, this is the hand I'm dealt with. This is what, you know, this is what I got to play. I don't even have a pair to play. But this is what I got. And it's nothing. It's not much. The other thing that as the night went on, because you remember the main guy wasn't there. He was gone and everything was quiet. And the other thing that popped through my head like a scratched old LP was the first verse of I Know My Redeemer Lives. The first verse of I Believe in Christ. And the third verse of Come, Come, Ye Saints, the one about, and shall we die before this journey's through, happy day? It's just over and over. I mean, and I like those hymns before, but wouldn't stop. And finally, it came morning. And by the way, one of the guys, not one of the original captors, but the guy who, the Mayan farmer who actually owned the farm, he was, and I'll tell you about him in a second, he brought us some water and some store cookies, you know, hard cookies. Neither one of us, of course, you know, are not in our stomach like this. So you don't feel like eating, but we were very thirsty, so we drank a drink of water. Okay, so morning comes. You hear a truck come back, our car, and they go out and hear a bunch of talking. And up to that point, I didn't have any hope, actually, but I figured as long as we're together, and they said they weren't going to kill her, hopefully we're going to be okay. You know, maybe there's more time on. Maybe the army might find us. Maybe the police might find us. Who knows? At that point, though, they took me out. My mom starts screaming, "No, no, please, no!" And I said, "Okay, this is it." They marched me across, and they didn't blindfold me this time, so that made me a little more certain that they didn't care what I saw. Remember, coming in, they had the blindfold, so we'd see how to get there, how to get out. I could see the farmhouse, you know, and the crops there, corn and stuff, and then they marched me into the jungle, further into the jungle. They told me to kneel down, so I kneeled down, and I said, "Okay, God, this is it. Here I come." And then once again, I reiterated, "Please help my wife to find something good to marry to take care of my kids, and please, if it's possible, let my mom get out of this mess." So I, you know, and then the last thing I said, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they do." And I don't know why I thought that, but when I said that, a peace came over me, like, okay, you're not perfect, you know, but you're ready to go.
I'm like this, okay? Kneel down and nothing happens. And I open my eyes. Nothing happens. So I turn around and I look back. These guys are standing there eating some fruit. There's a slice of some fruit. And I said, what's going on? I thought you were going to kill me now. They said, no. And they start laughing. No. Not now. Just, we'll do it later. We'll do it when the boss tells us. Not until the boss tells us. You know, of course, that's in Spanish. Hey, that's a little bit of an emotional roller coaster. You think, well, okay, I got a few more minutes, an hour, a few more hours, or something. So in the meantime, though, they cleaned my mom up, and she had blood all over her shirt and down to here. It looked like she'd been, in a war. And I didn't know this, but she told me later. They cleaned her up, washed her off, and put her in this little Mayan dress. My mom's 5'10". And the dress was about 5 sizes too small. It was the funniest thing. If it wasn't so sad, it would have been really funny. It was like, worth, dress for success, not. They took us further in the jungle. They brought her to me, and then we went further in the jungle. And I said, what are you doing? He said, apparently the army's looking for you, so we're moving you further away because there's no chance to get caught. I'm thinking, good, maybe there's a chance now because the army, is looking for us. Little did I know that was not true. The army wasn't looking for us. I can come to find out later. So, I know I'm boring you with this. I'm going to try to wrap it up. In a nutshell, then, the boss came back. He couldn't get the ATM card to work. I'm racking my brain on how we can help him out. Try to get some money. Maybe that'll soften him somehow. And so she got this Visa card. I said, look, go to town, buy some things with the Visa card. And then you can sell those for cash and get some money for medicine for your boy, They say, oh, that's a good idea. So then he takes the Visa card, goes to town, gone for 6 hours, comes back, and has some credit card slips that he has my mom sign. Don't know how much it is, but later she found out, of course, in her statement, it was, $3,000 or $4,000. That she didn't have to pay, though, because it was a duress situation. So that was not an issue. But that wouldn't be a big deal anyway, right? $3,000 or $4,000 is nothing. And so then, as the course of the afternoon goes on, it's really hot. The Mayan farmer, he brings out this little tarp thing, and he ties it up to 4 trees, about 4x4. So we're trying to sit under that as the sun's beating down through through the trees, having to move every 15 minutes because the shade is so small. And they get so the boss comes back about 4 o'clock, and he says, okay, here's the deal. And they've been telling us the whole time, they're going to kill us. You're not going to get away. The Mayan farmer, by the way, let me throw this in because this is important. He said, when that one guy went off to go to the bathroom, because two guys went to town, the two guys, the mine farmer and the guy with the shotgun staying there. The one guy went to the bathroom a little ways away, out of respect for my mom, I guess. And the mine farmer said, look, I'm not part of these guys. I got to let you know right now, I'm not part of this gang. They are paying me 2,400 pesos, with 2,400 pesos was about 240 bucks at the time, at the currency at that point. And they came here a few days ago, told me they were going to bring some people back here, and that if I didn't cooperate, they would kill me and my wife and my 8 kids. And he said, I just want to, I'm not part of this. Even though I'm helping, you got to know that it wasn't my part of the plan. I wasn't part of supposed to be in this. And he was a nice guy. He's the guy that brought us the cooked crackers and water, right? So then he said, if I can, I'll try to talk them into having me kill you after they leave, and maybe we can get you away somehow. Maybe. And then he said, and I said, look, I'll pay you 10 times, I'll pay you 100 times what they're paying you. I'll take you with me. And he said, well, yeah, but how could we do with my 8 kids? We couldn't ever get all of us into the States. He was pretty realistic about that. The main boss comes back, and there's a big heated argument between the 4 of them, the Mayan and the other 3 guys. The 2 guys that were left to guard us the whole time were arguing against the driver and the boss. And I couldn't hear what they were saying. I couldn't hear, it was too far away. But it was pretty violent. They came back, and the boss says, okay. And my mom had been praying that their hearts would be softened, and that they might let us go. And I didn't give that a whole lot of credence because I guess I didn't have the faith, or I didn't have the reason to want to even have a hope that I could believe that. They come back and the guy says, okay, because these 2 guys, they're pleading for your lives, if you give me $5,000, we'll let you go. That's the first time that they'd said that. Of course, that's pretty easy to say before they get the money, right? When's the last time you ever believed a crook, you know, a bad guy? And by the way, keep in mind, he's already got the money for the medicine for his leukemia kid, right, allegedly. So I said, look, all my money's in my truck. He said, do you know anybody's got any money? He said, well, yeah, I know. I've got a rich friend up in Cancun. He could maybe get it. And then he kept going down on the price, believe it or not. I wasn't trying to negotiate. I'm a pretty good negotiator, but I was not in the mood to negotiate for anything, you know. And he just came back and said, okay, you know what? Don't worry. $4,000 and we might let you live. Okay, just we got to get the money. And by the time he reached his cell phone, he says, okay, you tell your friend $3,000and maybe we won't, you know, and maybe we won't kill you. Well, and then he said, he wouldn't let me tell the friend what had happened. He actually told me, with a gun in my head, you tell the friend that you were attacked in a traffic accident in Chetumal with a taxi, you know, and down there, Kinchoki, barely, so whoever hits pays, kind of thing. It's not uncommon for someone that, in order to get out of jail, to pay some money to get out of the jail. So I told him, I said, look, so I called my friend in Cancun, and he wasn't home. This is about 4:45 now, and this is Monday afternoon, okay? I said, now I don't know what to do. And then all of a sudden I remembered I had another friend who ran the golf course who might have access to that kind of money. So I call up my friend Marty. I get him. I said, you know, Marty. He says, look, there's not time to go to the bank. But he ran the golf course in Cancun. He said, look, call me back in 15 minutes. So he goes to the cash register in the bar. He goes to the cash register at the restaurant. He goes to the safe at the club. Everywhere. And later on he tells me he had exactly $3,000. Is that strange? You know, if the guy had demanded $5,000, you know, the numbers wouldn't have worked. But he had exactly $3,000. So I go back 15 minutes. Marty, yeah. Okay, can you Western Union it down to, you know, to the Walmart and ship them off? He said, yeah. So he wired the money. The number one bad guy, the boss, said, okay, because they've been bleeding for your life, here's what we'll do. If the $3,000 is there, I told my men to let you go after dark. But if it's not there, I'm coming back and we'll keep you right now. No more questions. No more messing around. So he and the driver left, went to Chitimal, and they never came back. Okay, so by dark, they start getting us ready to hike out. It was about a 5-mile hike up to the highway. And at this point, you know, you still don't know. You still don't really want to believe or have hope that, hey, this might be really over. Because sure as I did, I knew that, you know, I get shot in the back. So we're walking out, hiking out, and it's, you know, it's really jungly, really thorny. My mom, you know, is tripping all the time. So I got myself, I said, hey, look, you got a time, I got to help carry her out. So we get out, and to the edge of the highway, and, well, going up that way, it was really, really jungly. I mean, really thick. I thought, you know, here's a perfect place to kill somebody. No one would ever, ever find you. So we get to the highway, and, you know, there's big transformers, power lines, and I thought, oh my gosh, we might actually get out of this. Then the Mexican farmer, the Mayan farmer, gives me 20 pesos, $2, to pay for the taxi, if I could find a taxi at midnight. This is Monday at midnight now, or Tuesday, actually, about 1 o'clock in the morning. So if the whole thing went from Sunday afternoon to 3 o'clock till 2 o'clock, till 1 o'clock in the morning Tuesday, we're all filthy. I've got blood all over me and from my mom and a little bit, and nobody would pick us up. You know, there weren't very many cars out there anyway. Nobody stopped. Truckers, cars. Finally, a taxi went by this way, and on his way back, about 15 minutes later, he actually stopped, thank goodness. And I said, look, can you take me to the army post in town? So we go there. He gets to the door. You know, luckily, he would accept, you know, 20 bucks, or 20 pesos was enough for him to take, even though it was less than what his fare would have been. Finally, we're able to get the car back after a couple days. The army had it. They thought that they had drug interdiction. They thought they had found the mother load, especially when they saw my mom's vitamins and, medicines and stuff there on the floorboard. They thought that they hit the mother load on the drug deal. So they brought the drug sniffing dog in. You know, the car is packed. I mean, the truck is packed. Drugs in the dog, sniffing. The only thing he finds is, you know, a ham and cheese bagel in the ice chest. And they were really disappointed at that point. After a couple days, we finally were able to get the car back from the FBI equivalent. They told us that, they contacted the American Embassy, our consul there in Cancun, tried to get Mexican notified. The Mexican was my mom. She was with me, so they never got hold of anybody. They couldn't get hold of my wife in Provo because she was staying at her parents' house and they weren't listed on the
list of contact. So basically, that's where they, so they tracked the investigation on, you know, from Cancun, then checked them all, and I said, well, I guess that's it. We can't do anything unless somebody turns in a missing persons report. And I knew that's how criminal investigations work when in Mexico. I didn't have a lot of hope that I would be found that way. God intervened, softened the hearts, heard my mom's prayers, and here I am. I should not be here today. I should be laying in a shallow grave. By the way, I don't know if I told you this, but the Mayan guy said, these people have killed before. They've done it, and they've used other people. I know about it. It added some credibility to my otherwise pessimistic outlook, right? You know, my realistic outlook. We drove as fast as, you know, I could have driven back to Cancun. My rich friend, I got in touch with him. He said, drive back here. We'll fly you home by helicopter, you know, or whatever. Get to the hell out of Mexico. And I said, no. And I said, I gotta finish what I started stupidly, right? So I drove so fast. There wasn't one car or truck that passed me. No car or truck passed me all the way up to the United States. And it still took a couple of days to get there, but you know, we stayed in highly populated areas, and we were very happy to get across the border. I've been back to Cancun several times since then. It's the first time I got off the airplane down there about 6 months after it happened, because I have some business down there still. Almost led to a panic attack. I was in my friend's car, I couldn't even breathe, but got over that and everything's fine. Had some flashbacks, originally my mom still does a little bit, but it's been, you know, it's been almost 8 years, and I hadn't even thought about it really until Doug asked me to talk about it for, you know, the past 3 years or so. What did I learn? Well, I learned that, you know, God is good. God is great, but sometimes life ain't fair, as the song goes. Or life ain't good. Sometimes life ain't good. And I realized, you know, and I learned that, you know, nothing really matters in life except the relationships, and especially relationships with God and your family. You know, I'd have paid anything to get out of that situation. For some reason, the whole experience only cost me, you know, $5,000 roughly, between my watch, my rings, in my ring, the cash in the car. Oh, I thought I was listening as a side note. The Army inventory, every single thing in that car, even to the little plastic trash can, you know, if you can believe that. Huge, long inventory. And then they asked me, and I didn't expect this, but, you know, I was bringing back some cash to the States, about $17,000, actually, it was under the back passenger seat. You know, folded all down, a ton of stuff on top of it, nobody would ever found it, except for Army guys inventorying a whole vehicle. No bad guys would have ever found that, so I don't believe. Anybody think, wow, that was a pretty stupid thing to do. Yeah, I was, so I was, you know, trying to, whatever, avoid bringing the, you know, sending it through to my bank account in the States and having to pay the taxes on that. So, anyway, they inventoried that. Some of the Army guys had stolen the $500 in gasoline money, pesos, but the $17,000 was still there, believe it or not. Unbelievable. So, anyway, it was a, that's the story, Doug. The good, the bad, and the ugly, and I am grateful to be alive. Thank you.